This is Local MASH.
Get inside and lock your doors.
Man, thank you so much for coming in.
The honor, man. Thank you for having me. Stoked.
Like I was telling you earlier, I really wanted to sit down where we could talk at more length for many years, because yeah. I've been watching you play and seen some of the arc, you know, of where your career has been. And like we were talking about earlier, I have great respect for the longevity, you know, that you've cultivated,
yeah,
and for the beautiful family that you have, and you know, the larger family of musicians
yep.
that you're, you know, connected with here in Birmingham, and wide-reaching influence with projects like Conor Oberst, and you know, so thanks for coming in again.
Yeah, man.
We're definitely going to talk about your new record, Tap Dancing Daddy, tonight, because it came out the night you played at Secret Stages. Is that correct?
Just came out. Yeah. So yeah, I think it was August. Or it might have been the night before.
Okay.
Somewhere around
like
there.
Like the first or second
of August. Yeah.
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 That was a great show, by the way, too. I didn't really get to see you that night, I don't think, but we were running around.
Yeah. A lot of good bands.
Trying to catch stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So definitely going to talk about the record. We are going to play you a good portion of Tap Dancing Daddy tonight in a minute. We'll play you the first three tracks. But before that, while many of you may know who Taylor Hollingsworth is and know him for his music or from seeing him around town, perhaps you've been waited on by him.
Playing
down at
everywhere.
Rojo.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you may know Conor Oberst's music, or you may have learned about his work through the visual art that he's making. It's the cover of this album, right? Is your one of your pieces from the last show that you had?
It is. Yep.
And I've got another one of those hanging at my house.
Yeah.
It's downstairs in the studio. We've actually been moving it around and putting it in front of the drum kit during the sessions.
Oh, cool.
Because I've got this big gobo, this baffle that I'm using. Uh-huh. And so the head is right there in front of the drummer. So there may be pictures popping up of that.
Nice.
Behind it's a crash pad that I use for a gobo, but I've got a climbing crash pad that I'm using behind the in front of the bass drum right now. Studio in the works.
Yeah.
But so if you will, I mean, you're from Birmingham, first of all.
I am. Yep.
Born and raised. You said you moved into that house when you were five, over?
Yep. A little apartment right off Euclid Avenue called Foxhall Road.
Yeah.
Grew up there. I lived in there from, 5 till I was 18. And got out of the house. Well, my mom actually got remarried at that time, so still lived with her for like another year. And then I was out of the
like
house.
You do.
For the most part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in how you started playing music, which I don't think I've ever asked you that.
Yeah. I guess.
Do you have musicians in your family? Like, was it a thing that was totally out of the realm of what everybody was doing that you were around? Like, how did you come to?
Well, my brother, actually, he's younger than me, and he started playing guitar before I did.
Van,
yeah.
I see him almost every day at the studio teaching at Mason.
Yeah, that's right. You guys work together.
Yeah.
I want to say probably a year before me, he got into it. And I was mostly into listening to music, you know, got super into like, you know, I was born in 1980, so when I was 12, 13, you know, was when like the grunge thing was like getting really big. So we were going through, you know, sort of difficult times at my house. My dad got sick and passed away. And I sort of latched on to that angst of, like, that music, you know, and it's kind of still tough for me to talk about, honestly, but, yeah, I like, sort of buried myself in my headphones and, you know.
It's one of the greatest things about music, the way that it can transport you and allow for healing, or at least processing.
Yeah.
You know, until you can get to that point.
A lot of emotions there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so got a guitar, like, 14, and, yeah, just kind of became, like, you know, I guess I just sort of identified quickly myself as, like, a guitar, or that's what I was going
to
do.
Just mapped to your being.
Yeah. I took to it pretty quick. I think I was pretty good, pretty fast for my age, at playing, and certainly had never been good at anything before. So,
I'm not hard to believe, but yeah.
I think, for me, it became like an identity, and, you know, to the kids at school or whatever, it's like, you know, that's who he is. He's the guy that plays guitar, you know, so.
We don't have to worry about him anymore. He's got a thing.
Exactly.
He's
going
to be okay.
Yeah, we don't have to
feel so much of that.
We don't
in
have
my
to
life.
Pick on him anymore. He's good at something now. He was terrible at sports and whatever else the kids did, you know. So yeah, I had that comfort, you know, of having something I could do.
Yeah.
So,
I definitely relate to that.
Yeah.
I tried at the sports. There were things that I liked to do, but I was never very good at them.
Sure.
Some of them I still like to do, but never in the way that the music, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I was like, you know, it was one of those things where you, like, think you're kind of, like, all right at it in your neighborhood, and then you get to, like, school or whatever. You know, we... I don't know what I should talk about on the radio. So we we were our parents moved us into Mountain Brook, you know, so we could go to that school system.
Yeah.
And we lived in a little, you know, like I said, a little apartment, and we were sort of like the have-nots in a, you know, area or neighborhood of haves. And you know, when you're a kid, like, you know, you don't know these things when you're real young, and then you get to junior high and you realize,
start
like,
figuring
oh, okay,
them out.
So, like, we're totally different, you know, and we didn't fit in very well, and that went along with sort of every aspect of that, you know, of growing up. It's like, you know, you think you're, like, good at basketball when you're playing in your backyard with your friends, and then you get there and it's like, oh, these kids have been, like,
it's a much bigger
trained since they were five with private courts in their backyard, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's
oh,
like,
yeah.
Oh, okay,
oh, you have a tennis court,
so I am
house.
Like nothing. Right. Yeah And then so I made the mistake of, like, I remember, like, my dad, he was still alive at this time, he was sick, but you know, we went to junior high, and I said, like, yeah, I want to play on the football team. And I remember him saying, like, are you sure? You know, like, I don't think that you want to do that. You know, and I was like, not all my all my friends are. Everybody's doing it. And then, you know, sure as heck, like, day one of that was, like, I'm this scrawny, tiny little kid. I remember my dad talked me into getting, like, my jersey number was 00, which, like, is hilarious now. He had a very dark, dry sense of humor, but which I guess I took from him as I got older.
I
but
so, maybe just a little bit.
Yeah, I was like basically like the dummy to, like, run into. You know, like, literally, like, I remember kids, like, fighting so they could, like, run into me at practice, you know. So, like, pretty soon I started skipping practice, you know. I was like, okay, this is definitely not what I want to be doing.
Just, like, parallels the time where you're sort of discovering the guitar as well.
Oh, yeah. And, parallels a lot of things going on in my life at that time. That was a rough time in a kid's life, you know, that age.
Well, and especially when you're going certain things at certain ages, it's definitely
right. Yeah. So, but you know, it you know, I guess gave me some pretty thick skin. I can take anything now. Still taking beatings, but
never stops.
You know, yeah.
I mean, that's just kind of life.
That's right. It never stops. But yeah, you know, got, you know, kept. I didn't take music super seriously at that age. You know, I took, you know, once I found a group of friends, you know, I took that a little more. I just wanted friends, you know, I just wanted to like hang out with people. So I really, you know, we played music. I had a couple guys that I played with back then, but never worked very hard at it until I was like, you know, later in my teenage years, like 19, 20, you know, and once I got real, you know, I got lucky. There was like, I don't know if you remember, there was this band called Flair.
I remember Flair.
And they, I worked with them at the what's now Crestline Bagel, this little bagel shop. And I was this, you know, confused sort of little hippie slash punk kid or something that worked in there. And they were, you know, they were 4 or 5 years older than me or something like that. And they, you know, they kind of took a liking to me or were at least super nice to me. And, they kind of taught, they, I remember I like tried out for their band and they, at first it didn't go very well and they kind of denied me. But one of the guys, Adam, who I still kind of owe a lot of gratitude to, he kind of pushed for me to keep trying. So I learned all their songs and went in there for one more practice and I kind of got the gig. So, you know, they were like a band with like a legit, like they had a record deal and were kind of doing stuff, you know. So for me to be like that age, like 19, 20, you know, to see a band like get a record deal was a big eye opener for me because it was like, oh, okay. So like people that I know are like, you can do this. This isn't something, you know, like I'd already always been told from my mom or from people, you know, from school or whatever, like, that's not a reality. You can't be a musician. You know, you can't
take that. But you can be a sports star.
Sure. Right. Exactly. If you're born with, you know, $1 million in your bank account. But so like, you know, that was cool, you know. So I got in this band. The band didn't last long. It kind of broke up pretty quick for personal reasons. But they introduced me to, at the time, what became my favorite bands. The Dexateens, Verbena.
Local acts.
Yeah, local stuff, you know. And then they introduced me to the Replacements and a lot of cool, you know, punk bands, you know, from back in the day. The Stooges and all this stuff. And I got, you know, super into that Big Star. I remember we were all listening to a lot of, like, Alex Chilton and stuff like that. And
Memphis connection,
yeah, and later that developed into a thing where I got to meet a lot of these people. But, you know,
were you aware at the time of all the Muscle Shoals stuff that had occurred? Like, was that part of your consciousness early on?
I was aware that it happened, but I wasn't like in tune with what exactly it was and what exactly happened there. I mean, I knew the Rolling Stones recorded some stuff there. You know what I mean? Like, and I knew Aretha Franklin, blah, 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 did her stuff there. But I didn't like, I wasn't like as into her records as I grew up, as I grew to be later. You know, I didn't appreciate them.
Sure.
I was still coming from punk and blues, you know. Like, I did get into blues really young, which was kind of weird, I guess, for a kid to be into. But than the grunge, I got into that too, because to me that was like, oh, this is, like, I loved the attitude of the grunge, but I also loved, like, these blues guys could, like,
definitely some crossover between those.
Yeah, and they can play, you know. It's like, mm-hmm. Oh, they can really play, you know. You know, from there, it was pretty cool because I ended up getting asked to play guitar in Verbena and the Dexateens, you know. So they mm-hmm. were my two favorite local bands. You know, by the time I was 20, 21, I was in both of them. Neither lasted super long. I was super excited to be in Verbena when that happened, but quickly realized that I was just like a fill-in. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying I was a fill-in, but like I had zero creative input. You know,
hard
what I mean?
Gun.
I was like, I'm gonna fill out the sound and be on stage, whatever.
Yeah,
which is fine, but like, you know, I was.
You had aspirations to do more than that,
right? Yeah, I was like, I wanted to be involved, you know.
Yeah,
and even though I probably didn't know how or to what capacity or what to even bring to the table, I mean, these guys are all 10 years older than me. Obviously they have way more experience, and you know, I'm a kid to them. But
yeah,
I still, you know, was stubborn and wanted to figure that out. So I remember I like didn't show up. I think I stayed up all night partying the night before. Like, well, so we went out to Los Angeles and stayed out there for like a month and a half or whatever. They recorded this, what became La Musica Negra.
Yeah.
Not my favorite of their records, but, you know, I was out there doing nothing, twiddling my thumbs. And you know, I was kind of like, what am I doing? Why am I here? You know? I mean, it's nice to see LA, but like, why am I here? You know? And when we come back, you know, I was like, okay, well, I'm not going to go to these practices because I'm not doing anything. And, you know, of course, they're like, well, we were going to get you, you know, the singer was like, well, we were going to get you on them, but now that you're not coming,
all right.
You know, it's not going to work out or whatever. I was like, you know, obviously.
The universe pushing you in a kind of a different direction.
So I don't know if I quit or got fired, but I'm glad that whatever it was happened.
I don't know if I quit or got fired.
So, and then shortly after, the Dexateens are like, hey, you should play with us. And these guys are like real deal rock and roll.
I've been seeing them in Auburn in the late 90s.
Oh, yeah. These guys were freaking great.
Mid to late 90s.
You know? And they made their first record, which was amazing, you know. And so I was super stoked to be playing with them. They took me to Europe for the first time. Did a little tour.
Really?
Yeah, when we were, I was probably 21 still. Or this all happened very fast. This was like a pretty short.
You're talking like 2001.
2001, 2002. I could have been 22. Yeah, somewhere. Yeah. Somewhere in that range.
That's about the time that I became aware of you playing, and it was through the Nick.
Yeah. So right at that time, I was still like sort of in the middle of all that. I got a 4-track, and I learned like the little cassette,
like Tascam.
Yep. The little Tascam. Yep. Mini Porta Studio.
Or yeah.
And I sat in what then was my parent. My mom had gotten remarried, and what was there, the house they moved in, there was a basement, and I sat in that basement and just wrote songs and like taught myself how to record them, and I played everything on it. You know, I got a drum machine. You know, I couldn't get a band together. You know, it's so hard to get a band.
I feel like I remember seeing you play solo.
Probably did.
And
yeah.
Before Macy and Brian started playing with you.
I did, yeah.
Was that your first like band that you kind of came together?
Sort of. Macy was definitely very early on. Brian came a little after a few other guys. Actually, Les Newby from Verbena ended
up holiday gunfire.
Yeah, yeah. But at the time, Verbena, whatever, had, I guess they had disbanded by this point. Yeah. And he
seems like it
was kind of showing kindness to me for the weirdness, I think. So he was like, yeah, I'll play with you. You know, so suddenly for me, I'm like, all right, I got this awesome drummer, you know. I think it was, I'm sure, horrible for him, you know, because it was like me and Macy were super young and we're like ready to party and we're like playing these terrible shows, you know, just anything we can get out of town. You know what I mean? Like the those first tours, you know, and he's putting up with us, you know, whatever. But he played South by Southwest with me and he played like a few weird shows, you know. We ended up, I ended up getting this, a manager, Dan Nolan, who owned the Nick with Pam and also owned Smith's Old Bar and some other places. And he ended up giving us, you know, pretty much every killer opening slot that came through Atlanta, you know, we opened for, you know, so we were already, you know, it was ridiculous, really, for like this young kid to have this band and be playing these insanely sold out shows. You know, I remember we played with like Jay Maskus and we played with like, people's name, Mason Jennings, you know, or
that's awesome.
I can't even remember them all. Todd Snyder, you know, like pretty crazy shows to like open for.
Yeah, and that's like a diverse kind of
range of... Because he saw me as a songwriter, but also as this rock and roll guy, whatever. And in which I guess I did too at the time. But, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I mean, I had zero amount of professionalism. I was just learning as I went. You know, so I'm playing these shows like... You know, I remember we opened up for John Mayer's first blues band, like when he changed from boy band or whatever he, you know, the soft acoustic thing that he was doing.
Your Body's the Wonderland.
Yeah, that stuff. When he decided he was going to be a blues singer, we got the first gig. He like did this gig at Smith's Old Bar. It was like unannounced, sold out in 5 seconds when he announced it or whatever. And, you know, we opened up, you know, so we were getting these crazy.
And you're still pretty much in Birmingham during that time, just driving over and.
Yeah, just driving over. Yeah. And we before long we got a van and we were starting to get gigs and we got this record deal in Atlanta by this label called Brash. You know, that was after Sky Bucket had put out my first 4-track record. Here, that was actually Sky Bucket's first release. Was your Taylor and the Puffs is what I called it.
Yeah.
And that was the thing I made in the basement at the house. So, anyway, I'm flying and
so chronologically,
weaving in and out.
Puffs before Spider Ears.
Puffs before Spider Ears. Yeah.
Yeah.
So once
Travis happened.
Travis was dude. Yeah. It was all Travis. Yeah. At the time.
Travis Morgan.
Yeah. You know, then we got this record deal, and then pretty soon we had these, like, showcases in Los Angeles. So we drove across the country, had shows along the way, and ended up getting a booking agent for the agency group, which is a really big booking agency. And he put us on the road for pretty much by the time this all happened and the record came out, we're getting into 2005, 2006. You know, around 2004, you know, there was a brief period there. My mom actually got sick and she passed away in 2004. Mm-hmm. So I did move back into the house and, you know, took care of her at the end of her life. Mm-hmm. So that kind of, you know, that kind of, there was like a minute, I guess a year to a year and a half where I was still going out and playing shows, but it was, you know, I was trying to not play as many and be home. And, but, you know, it was really difficult because it was right when I had all these things happening, you know. Yeah. So we were trying to take as much as we could.
Life's weird like that. You get the best opportunity you've ever had, and then you get just kind of like, yeah, just like kicked to the ground.
I know, yeah.
At the same time.
Still have to apologize to some clubs and places because I was really not in a good place at that time, you know. Yeah, I remember, yeah, like one time, you know, complaining about the sound. Like I'd walk off the stage after two songs, you know, or something. Just being like a young brat, you know.
Little punk.
Yeah. And I, you know, and I loved punk stuff. So I was, not only was I into it, I was also mentally in such a, like, bad place to, like, see it from a different, from a real perspective of, like.
It's a trade-off,
you,
yeah,
know, like, yeah, okay, everybody else is a human going through their own stuff, you know. You don't have to treat people poorly, but, you know, when you're young and your life's being thrown at you pretty hard, you know, it's. You kind of only see what you got going on right in front of you. But
and a lot of people are just hole up in their house while they're dealing with this stuff. And so you work it all out in private. And it,
yeah.
And then.
And heavy drinking and stuff like that, you know.
But, you know, being out in public, you're going to end up dealing with,
yeah,
stuff in a different way. You
know?
Yeah.
So from there, I made this record and didn't like it. Really, because I thought it was too polished and too produced for what I was trying to do. You know, I wanted it to be more punk and blah, blah, blah. So I said that I was going to make the record I wanted, and that was going to be it. And they could take it or leave it on the label. This is right when I met. I met Connor Oberst right around this time, and we became pretty fast friends.
What year is this about?
I mean, we probably met around 2004, maybe, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we were staying in touch, so this was probably 2006, you know. Well, he, you know, at this time, he was at the height, you know, I mean, Bright Eyes was really huge.
Yeah.
And they had just released, or were about to release Casadega.
Mm-hmm.
And he built this crazy studio in Omaha, like, you know, this super nice studio. And he offered for me to come up there and make my next record for free. You know, he was like, it'll be free. You know, I'll pay for it or whatever. You know, you can use the space for free. And, and I thought...
Had you started performing with him at this time, or was this before that?
No, this was before that. I mean, I think I'd played, like, one Birmingham show, just, like, a Christmas thing he did. Yeah, I had done that, like, a year before, but
yeah,
not really. So I went up there, and that's what, you know, my response record to Tragic City was. It's called Bad Little Kitty, which is literally the opposite record,
mm-hmm,
you could make. You know, it's super wacky, crazy, very, I would say, like, southern punk, like, art music or something,
mm-hmm.
You know? I was really heavily influenced by, like, ZZ Top and Wire Pink Flag simultaneously. So, like, basically that record was, like, I wanted to make, like, this record that was, like, combining those two kind of things, you know? And yeah, also, like, Chuck Berry mixed with punk stuff. I'd also, be like, played a few shows with the Black Lips at that time and bands like that. And so I was, yeah, also really into getting into the garage thing, you know. But anyway, so we made this kind of crazy record at Connor's studio. And I remember turning it into the label and saying, this is the record. And they were like, no. You know, they were basically like, we love you, and like, we want to give you a budget for you to go into another studio and make a different record. But we want it to be like Tragic City, the record before,
mm-hmm,
the produced one.
Mm-hmm.
And... but there's no hard feelings if this is what you want to put out. But, you know, they didn't want to put that out. So I was stubborn and.
Were they sort of like, you can do this on your own, but we still need you to
No,
do this,
they were willing to let me go. They were totally cool.
Okay.
They were like, but we're just not going to put that record
That's
out.
That's awesome.
They gave me an option, you know.
Yeah.
They were totally nice guys, you know, but they just didn't get what, they were very business-minded and from a different generation of, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, absolutely.
They didn't get what I was trying to do
at all. An interesting changing of the guard going on during that time as far as the
industry,
the
everything.
Infrastructure of the industry,
yeah,
and who were filling the jobs and how old they were, and the millennial thing hitting,
right? There's
mm-hmm.
all that stuff, digital
stuff,
you know. So anyway, I was like, okay, well, thank you so much for everything you've done. You know, I was always cool with them; they were very nice. You know, I remember thanking them for the budget that they had given me, which was a large budget, and they gave me money to tour and everything. And but I said, you know, this is what I have to do right now, you know. And I thought that I would be able to shop it and get it put out pretty quick, and turns out it was too crazy for every label I gave it to. They all thought that I was insane, and even the crazy punk labels, you know, like I thought that would be into it. And then the booking agent quickly, I remember getting the phone call from him like, hey, if you're not going to do this next record with this label and have this budget, and like, then we're going to have to let you go, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was just, when anybody says something like that, you're just like, well, bye. You know,
yeah.
So I remember saying, okay, well, thanks, but this is what I'm doing. Still being stubborn, you know. So I lost the booking agent and the label, and then pretty much the manager too. You know, so I was back to kind of like square one, back in Birmingham, with a record that wasn't being put out by anybody. And I'm hanging out with my friend, you know, when we're doing bad stuff, you know, or doing drugs and drinking and stuff.
So maybe this is a good point to cut for a second and segue, and we'll come back in just a minute after we listen to some of the tunes.
Yeah.
Yeah?
But, yeah.
Finish what you're going to say.
Well, this is just that's part one, and then from there goes into more like the current. It leads into the current sound of this record.
Word. Yeah.
So.
Okay.
But
cool.
This record is a bit of a mix, I would say, of
I'd
the
agree.
Old sound
I'd agree.
Mixed with
I'd
the
agree.
Newer stuff.
I think it's nice. It's a nice balance of the two.
Yeah.
I'm really excited about it.
Yeah. All right.
Like
cool.
I said, I'm going to spend a little bit more time just listening all the way through, because that's what I like to do, is listen to records all the way through. And I highly recommend anybody that doesn't do that, just plays one song.
Oh, yeah.
And
you gotta listen
on.
To the whole record.
You
gotta
it.
Play it loud.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, man, but you gotta listen. If you don't listen to the music loud, then you're not listening. That's just my personal belief. But, like, if you're listening to it where you can still talk to people, you're not listening. You know, you're not really
this
listening.
Background noise.
Yeah.
This elevator
I like
music.
To rock out. You know, like, even if it's a calm, chill album, it's gotta be loud, man. It's got to be.
All right. Well, we'll be right back. You're listening to Local Mash, and this is Taylor Hollingsworth.
Thank you. Shout, seems that mansion on the hill ought to divvy something.
This is indeed Local MASH, and I'm Daniel Long, and fortunate to have Taylor Hollingsworth here tonight, one of my inspirations in the music community in Birmingham, and somebody that I, like I said earlier, I probably feel a little bit closer to than I actually am, but I'm real excited that we got to sit down and talk tonight.
It's been fun.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah.
We're not done yet. We're going to play you some more music from the new record, Tap Dancing Daddy. But picking up where we left off, post-Tragic City.
After, yes.
And?
Let's see. Tragic City, then it was Bad Little Kitty.
Bad Little Kitty.
So, yeah. Oh, yeah. Back to ground zero at that time. Back in Birmingham. This is when, from there, let's see, that's when, you know, I darted off out west and kind of ventured around, hung around Colorado, New Mexico, California, Utah, sort of bounced around, stayed with people, kind of just going no place, you know, on purpose, but kind of living on people's couches or whatever.
Yeah.
And kind of came back, guess I came back to Birmingham for a little bit and then went down to Mexico to see Macy had gone down there to play with Connor. I also had another friend who was living in Mexico City. So, flew into Mexico City, stayed there for a few days. And then went to this little town called Tepoztlan, which was hour and a half south. Let's see, I could be wrong. I think it's an hour and a half southeast, sort of, Mexico City. And Connor had rented sort of this little, I don't know what you would call it, like a, not like a, not a hotel, I mean, not a house, but like sort of this little mini villa. Yeah, like a bunch of little houses in like a little area.
Like a compound. Like everything is in Central and South America. You've got like little
compounds.
Enclaves.
Okay, yeah, that's right. The word. That's a good word. That's a good
sounds
word.
Sounds real
this.
Militant, but.
Yeah. So he rented this little compound. And I got there and he was like, he had wheeled in a inch tape machine with a board and all this stuff, and he was making his first solo record. And he was like, hey, I saved you some spaces for you to play some guitar solos.
Did you know that was going to happen when you got there?
No, I had no idea. So I got there, and I was like, oh, great, you know. Played several songs on that record. You know, not thinking anything about it. Just, that was great. Got home. He sent me some money for it, which I was like, wow, you know, I didn't ask to be paid or anything like that. And, you know, he's always takes care of everybody really well. Mm-hmm. And then within like a month, I guess, I got this email from his management saying, hey, Connor's requested you to do these tours. Would you like to do them? Here's the dates. Here's the pay, whatever, blah, blah, blah. You'll be gone from this time to this time. And, you know, it's perfect timing because, like I said, I lost all my stuff. So I was like, yeah, you know, this will be great. I can play lead guitar for this dude who's doing really, really well, you know. And that tour ended up turning into this long, long tour, you know. Mm-hmm. As we went, we worked in. He was, you know, this is, you know, he's writing these, you know, I don't know if you've spent much time with Casadega, but it's an amazing record.
Yeah.
And then his first solo record is pretty, you know, I guess I'm biased because I played on it, but, you know, his songwriting was truly hitting a very high mark. I mean, I think Rolling Stone actually called him the best songwriter of that year.
Yeah.
You know, so he was getting well known for writing right during this time period. And I was lucky, you know, to play guitar on a lot of that. And so he's cranking out songs as we're touring, you know, we're working up new songs into the set regularly at soundcheck, you know, just here's another song I wrote last night, let's learn it, and we played it
like
at the show.
Songwriters do.
And you know, every night we're just throwing out these songs, and the tour was coming to an end, and at some point, I guess about a month before it ended, my timeline could be off, but he said, hey, we got all these new songs, you know, should we just go straight to the studio from the end of this tour and record another record? So that ended up being the Mystic Valley Band, Connor Oberst and the Mystic Valley Band. And
great foresight.
And he was, that ended up being like a double album sort of thing, like really long. You know, he wanted to include, you know, everybody in the band, pretty most, not everybody, but three of the people other than him were songwriters. So he wanted us to write songs too. So I, you know, I contributed two songs. Nick Freitas contributed two songs, and Jason Bozell contributed two songs, and ended up being this massive, long sort of project that we like all had all the stuff on. And pretty soon that, you know, that was scheduled to be released within like 3 months or something pretty crazy.
Y'all did it with a quickness.
We did it in about 2 weeks. Yeah. We recorded in 2 weeks in, outside of El Paso, Texas at this studio called Sonic Ranch. And you know, that was
a great name.
Crazy studio in the middle of, a pecan orchard. And the guy that owned the studio is a super interesting dude. And he's also pretty crazy guitar collector. So on that record, I actually played like one of Stevie Ray Vaughan's guitars. I played one of Slash's guitars. I think one of Billy Gibbons' guitars. There's a lot of, you know, crazy, crazy stuff on that record.
Awesome, man.
Yeah. It's pretty funny and weird.
I was trying to bid on some of Jimmy Chamberlain's drum stuff on Reverb when he was selling everything off.
Oh, really?
Like, I just, like, I appreciate the life of an instrument and the...
Yeah.
The,
You would have liked the studio. Still there, if you ever go through there.
Sonic Ranch.
Yeah, it's in Tornillo. Actually, it's where a lot of the crazy stuff has been going on with the wall and the...
Yeah.
Right outside of El Paso. Anyway, so yeah, that record comes out and we do another full tour. You know, it's like, okay, well now we gotta go play,
support the record,
support this record. They actually made a documentary about all of this, called One of My Kind.
I haven't seen this.
Yeah, I think it's on you can probably see it on YouTube, or
One of My Kind, so look for it. Yeah,
yeah, it's definitely on YouTube. I don't know, you might be able to get it somewhere else. I think it came, actually, yeah, we released all the B-sides that we recorded, and like maybe a 7-inch or something, I could be wrong, and that came with the documentary. So anyway.
Is it still available?
I think so, yeah, I think it's still available. I think Merge Records maybe put that out, or that one might have been Team Love, the documentary. Merge put out the record.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that finally ends. I come home, make this album called Life with a Slow Ear, which is more acoustic songs and stuff that I've been working on. And I played some solo shows and was sort of trying to start back over a little bit. Me and Kate, during this time period, became a couple. And, you know, through during that whole, all the touring and all that stuff. And when it ended, we moved in together and...
Dead Fingers.
Then we started Dead Fingers. That's right. So we... I was supposed to be doing a solo record with Bruce Watson over from Fat Possum Records.
Yeah.
And he has a little imprint on it called Big Legal Mess, which is basically his version of Fat Possum.
Yeah.
And he asked me to do a 7-inch, which was 2 songs, to come over there and record them. And then from there, he was like, hey, let's make it a full length. You know, things were going well. And then I brought Kate to sing on stuff, and then it was kind of like, you know, I told him about the idea of Dead Fingers, and he liked the idea of a new name, like, because I had kind of been doing my name for a while, and mm-hmm. he thought a change would be good, and it being the two of us would be good, so.
Is that like Cedric Burnside?
Yeah, and- no. R.L. Burnside.
R.L. Burnside.
Yeah. Not Cedric something. Was later. Yeah.
Okay.
He might have had something. Did he do some stuff? He might have had something on there. Maybe so. I could be wrong. But, you know, I was a fan from T Model Ford. And
yeah.
Actually, my first tour, I sold merch. I was like 20 years old. Was for Paul Wine Jones, one of the old blues guys.
Yeah.
I forgot to put that in earlier on. That was fun. That was a cool tour.
Wow, that's...
20 years old. Slept in the bed with the 70-year-old blues guy from Mississippi.
So once in a lifetime.
Yeah, it was a big influence on me. But anyway, yeah, so, you know, I thought it was super cool to be on that label and stuff. Made that record, toured U.S. and Europe, but at the time was right when we had Ava. She actually went to Europe with us as a babe. She was like 7 months old, which is insane. But we had a tour scheduled, and we brought her, which babies travel really well, surprisingly. And Kate's mom had to come and be a tour nanny so we could play. And she would go to the hotels every night with the baby, like, first. We would get into town, go to the hotel, settle them in, and then we would go to the club, do the show. Then Kate would go straight back to the hotel, and I would handle the load-in, load-out, all the business stuff. So anyway, then we made the second Dead Fingers record. But, you know, due to our at that point it was pretty apparent we weren't going to be able to tour like that. We had a baby, you know, not what we needed to do. So, you know, it was kind of, at that time, Bruce, I remember he said, like, look, we're going to have to cut the budget. You know, the record's great, but, we can't spend all this if you can't get out there.
And support it.
And get after it. Yeah. And, you know, that made sense, and I was pretty burnt out, man, up from touring. I mean, I'd been touring and touring and touring for 10 years at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, because I remember seeing you all the time, and then.
None.
only on social media and on television and on, and on things.
Yeah. And then I was back from there. So, that record we decided right. That was right when Communicating Vessels and all that stuff started happening in Birmingham, and I asked Bruce and, hey, there's a local label. You know, I think maybe it'd be cool if we did it with these guys. They seemed into it. So, you know, Bruce actually gave us the record free of charge. He recorded it, paid even for it.
Wow.
gave us the record, and we gave it to them.
Wow, that's amazing.
Put it out, yeah. And, we didn't really do much with that one, but, you know, that kind of came out. And after that, I mean, I slipped in a few little solo records in there, but without any promotion, really. I just kind of recorded stuff and put them out myself, but I didn't do anything. I literally, like, did zero promotion, and I just put them up on Spotify or put them up on iTunes through a digital distribution that you can, you know, you can just do that now.
Yeah.
You know, so I did some stuff like that, but
technology.
I did zero touring or anything for it or any promotion. But, I made a couple records with other records that are out there, but didn't really do anything. This is the first one I've done in a while where I recorded it back at my house, like, you know, sort of how I used to do in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sounds a little, I have nice, a little bit nicer stuff. Not super nice, but.
Yeah, but all the drum sounds are great and all the extra percussive sounds and those killer, like, just crazy ambient guitar things that are interspersed all throughout different.
Yeah, so I played scenes. Everything on that record and just did it myself. And Kate's sister and her husband, Maria Taylor and Ryan Dwyer, they started this label in Los Angeles called Flower Moon Records. And they expressed interest in putting it out. So we did that, and here we are.
And then you had to make something to put on the cover.
Yeah, during this time, I started doing visual art. Yeah, I did that actually when Ava was born. You know, I kind of realized I needed to not make so much noise. You know, got a baby around.
So I've had a similar conversation with Garrett Kelly about him delving into doing some of the video editing / multimedia things that he's been doing.
Yeah.
And to do art time with the kids, you know, and it becoming part of their social media presence and their, you know, like.
The outcome's the same, you know, like when I realized I got it, you know, my first stuff was very like drawing. I was just kind of drawing, and I started drawing with like Sharpies and paint pens and stuff. And I would buy old thrift store frames and frame them. And then I got into paint more. Now I use mostly paint, but sort of built off of that style that I started with. But, you know, the creative output, you know, or the feeling you get when you finish something, you know, is the same, you know, is you know, the most excited I get still to this day is the final product of something that you created out of thin air. You know, I mean, you know, when you write a song
for like 20 minutes
or when you,
and then you're like, oh man, I'm going to do this next time and this stuff. No, I'm sorry.
But I mean,
no, for me,
I get it, man. I like coming up with something out of nothing, and in a way each song has its own life now, you know what I mean, like they're alive in their own way and they're alive in people's heads, and they can do whatever they do, you know. Each song might do a different thing. Some songs might not swim very well, and some songs might fly like a take off in a spaceship. You know, it's the same for art, you know. But for me, is that first moment of seeing the finished product or listening to it or
when
whatever.
You finally decided,
it's the same.
I got to stop. I'm done. If I do any more, it's going to be worse.
Yeah. Right? Sometimes. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes. Sometimes, you know.
It's like, no, that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. I try to go for that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If the feeling's there, then you got to let it just live how it is, because you felt that way for a reason, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying I don't go back sometimes and listen to things and like, whoa, I would do that different now. But, you know,
of course,
it's all about a time stamp.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, that's
the
whole point of art. I mean, in a way, is your where you are at that point of time. You know, it's like some form of a diary or documentation that you lived and you were there. Mm-hmm. You know, so creating is super important to me, you know, and I do think that in a way it enables you to live forever, sort of, you know, and your family or your whoever picks up on what you do, you know.
Like, I feel like I'm constantly trying to find the media that are more, have more staying power, that are more.
Yeah, it's hard. Hard nowadays because there's so much, and we're getting just slammed by advertisements or mass produced, you know, sounds or images or whatever that are there for different reasons, you know. But like, if you really, you know, look through the thick of it, I mean, it's all still there, you know. Like, there's real people's art, and there's real.
It's not all fake news.
There's real music. Yeah, yeah. Isn't it great that you can just say this is fake news? Everybody's gonna oh, it is. Oh, okay.
Don't I feel sheepish?
You know, yeah. I used to like. It's like if you got 10 people standing in front of you. Don't get me started on all this. You just did. Too late. You know, 9 of them are telling you one thing, and one of them's telling you the other thing. Who are you going to believe, the 9 or the 1? Well, then when the 1's over here, their side man's over here like, those 9 are all lying. You know, like, you're going to believe it?
I don't like okay. lying.
Okay, that makes a whole lot of sense.
Lying's bad.
Yeah. Anyway, that's our
perception's a really interesting thing, but I think we do all have the responsibility to sort of check ourselves and realize there is an entire world of just sales that's going on, you know, and agendas that other people are trying to push.
Yeah, you.
And it, I mean, yeah, people
you need to know that.
Yeah. I'm not devaluing anything, but you need to realize that you need to step away from what everyone else is telling you.
Yeah, and decide for yourself.
Check your sources. Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, like they taught us in elementary school, you know, check your sources. Don't just take
the
15 people on Facebook told me, go somewhere other than Facebook.
People to jump on a hate bandwagon or whatever. You know, if they can see something, they're, you know, people love that, man.
Everybody needs a cause. We all want to be part of something.
And people are lazy, too.
And people are
they are.
Yeah, I have to kick myself all the time just to make sure that I'm not. We all have thoughts, and it's like, that's a thought. That's not what I believe, or that's not what I think, but that's a thought that I just had.
Yeah.
So, you know, spend some time thinking about whether or not the first or second or third thing that you think about something is worthwhile. I mean, I think this goes back.
And don't be scared.
Don't be scared. This goes back to why people like yourself that are creating things, you learn to edit and you learn to communicate in a way that transcends words or images.
It's its own language.
Yeah.
Art and music, all that, you know, it really is. Mm-hmm. It's a form of communication, you know, in a certain kind of way.
We'll have to have another conversation at some point where we can delve in more to the way that you write and the way that you play, because I really want to talk to you about that stuff too. And I mean, you've mentioned the blues a bit, and that's been something I could tell you grabbed a hold of really early, which is extremely emotive and connected in the roots of Southern kinds of music, for one thing. Mm-hmm. But then the way that you translate it, and then your vocal writing style, and the way that you sing, even, you know, I mean, like the way that it's developed through the years is something that's really exciting to me, to see how you've crafted what you do into what it is. And it's honed into something that's much bigger than all the parts of, you know. Anyway, that's just to plant a seed for another conversation. But
we'll have to do it again.
We got to do it again. Yeah. We got to get together more often.
Yeah.
So before we get out of here, Tap Dancing Daddy, which we've been listening to throughout the night.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to say as far as what you're thinking right now, just having released it, and given what we talked about already and about the different projects you've been a part of and the different records and all of the life experience and being a dad now and being able to create music with your partner and all of the new things that are what your life is now, what do you have to say about this, you know?
Oh, so I got to put all that into one
not easy thing.
I would say, you know, I mean, I think that record is it's definitely a true testament of where I've been and where I'm at now. And I think it's got a good variety of all the places I've been, you know, in there. Mm-hmm. I think it's got some stuff that kind of goes back to how I began, and a lot of the approaches are sort of the same as the way that I started. Mm. And definitely that I played everything and did everything myself. You know, a lot of that stuff I truly like make up as I go, you know.
So is this all you?
That's all me, yeah.
The drums and everything.
Everything, yeah. Kate did sing on one song, yeah. She sang back up on one song. But yeah, I played all the sounds.
We got to have another drum conversation too, in addition to the conversation about guitar and about
vocal, that's all drum machine. I mean, everything on there is, you know, like just like how I began, you know, I mean. The drums on there. I mean, not all the percussion and everything, but like the snare is a drum machine beat, you know, that I recorded.
We definitely got to talk about that.
And then everything else I played, you know. But
Wes McDonald came in and I asked him some questions about, because, I mean, he's also a kick-ass
drummer. He's a great drummer, yeah.
And he's like, well, you're probably not going to like it as much when I tell you how I did it. Like, what? Yeah. He's like, well, I had to be really quiet downstairs. And, you know, like the only thing that was, you know, like an acoustic instrument was the hi-hat, because I couldn't get my electronic kit to open up the way that I wanted to with, like, when I was using the open hi-hat.
Uh-huh.
I was like, but everything else,
yeah,
this electronic kit that I have.
Yeah.
I think that makes me like it even more.
Yeah.
Because, again, like, I wouldn't have known that.
Yeah.
But...
You know, over the years, you learn what things are supposed to sound like. Yeah. And, you know, also, technology now is, like, so good. I mean, the drum machines now literally are, like, samples of real drums. So it's not that hard to... Yeah. I mean, I can control, like, the velocity of each hit with the stick. And, like, I can make it sound... I didn't even take that much time. Like, I could have gone crazy with it, but... You know, I'm still a minimalist at heart, so, you know, I try to keep things very simple, you know.
Me too.
I write, the way I write, I try to write now in the way that I can still perform it live, and it's going to give it, I can play, you know, give it justice live, you know. When I started, I did add parts to fill out the sound. And then when I play live, it's like, oh, I don't have this person playing this melody or whatever. You know, I did get rid of all that stuff. So there are sounds on there, but there are things that you can have, you can go without, you know.
Yeah.
Just kind of.
And it's amazing to see just the duo play.
Yeah, I still play a lot with the duo, yeah.
So I feel like we should give a shout out to your,
Alan, yeah.
Yeah, to your resident
Ross
drummer.
Dog Rosser, yeah.
Yeah, man,
he's killing it.
And I told him the other night, he's been listening and been around long enough to now he can match. I won't say in the same way that Kate does, But he understands, because she's got some sort of other level understanding about how to sing with people that a lot of people she's don't ever have, even if they have a great voice, you know. But the way y'all's voices blend is something really special.
Yeah.
And he's figured out the way he can do that, too, while he's back there behind the kit.
Yeah.
And that just floors me, you know. Yeah. I mean, finding it, that's great, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean,
he's doing a great job, for sure. I told him, you know, the other day that he's definitely making it to where I have to play with him. You know, and he's like, well, that's what I've been trying to do. I used to be able to fluctuate through musicians or whatever, and he's certainly made it to where it's like, okay, I can't play a show without you now, because, like, you made my stuff sound so good, you know. So,
And whether y'all are,
but we get along good. We travel good together, and you know, we have fun. So, yeah, it's a good duo.
All right. Well, Flower Moon Records, Tap Dance and Daddy, Taylor Hollingsworth solo record. Go find it.
Yep. It's on iTunes, all that stuff. And, my website, taylorhollingsworth.org. And that's got all my albums on there, including some of the side weird stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You can get on there, too. Shirts and stuff like that, too.
All right. Do it up.
There shouldn't be no law for people who want to smoke a little dope.
I love these.
sudden smoke dope. No, there should be no law for people who want to smoke a little dope. I love to smoke dope, I love to smoke dope. It's good for your mind, it be like your body, don't you know?
This is Local Mash.
Local Mash.